And we're back. Hope everybody had a nice long weekend. If you had a long weekend, does the U.S. give people a day off this last weekend? Eesh, I really have been out for a while, haven't I? In any case, in this episode, we're going to discuss the differences between the U.S. justice system's slow response to January 6th as compared to the response from another large, multi-ethnic Western Hemisphere democracy's response to an attempt by that country's right-wing populist authoritarian leader to violently overturn an election he lost. We're going to discuss the need by the Democrats for the sort of giant, glitzy, star-studded fundraiser thingy put on by the Biden campaign in New York this past week. Also, the ongoing Russian campaign to kidnap Western civilians to use as political bargaining chips. And speaking of Russian campaigns, Donald Trump, traveling Bible salesman. Let's get into it. Hey, everybody. Welcome to OK Talks. I'm your host, Oliver Kendall. I'm a lifelong political nerd with an academic background in international relations focus and security policy, and real-world experience working in the U.S. domestic political space and living in a number of other countries than my own, all of which combined, I think, positions me fairly well both to interpret for my international audience what's going on in the politics of my own country, and to shed light for some of the folks back home on some events of note going on in the rest of the world. So, building on what I did last week, this is going to be another OK Takes episode, where rather than a deep dive on one particular topic, I discuss a bit more off the cuff several things that came up over the last week. So then, here we go, take one. So, in the last episode of this podcast and various previous ones, I've voiced frustration with how slow the wheels of justice in America seem to be turning when it comes to Donald Trump, and particularly how slow the reaction of the entire American system has been to the failed coup attempt leading up to and on January 6, 2001. To me, the slowness of the response, the relatively light sentences for having attacked the Capitol and tried to violently overturn an election when compared to the sentences that people in America face for other crimes, has been really just a travesty. And, you know, I think that that slow response is also substantially increase the possibility that far-right forces in the United States will try to do the same thing again in the next election. And, you know, people tell me, oh, Oliver, these sorts of investigations are complicated and take a long time, but, like, okay, I maintain, based on all the things that I just said a second ago, I think that the way this has been handled in the United States has been overall a fail, and, you know, will make it more likely that something similar happens again. And, you know, the interesting thing is, we do, in fact, right there in the Western Hemisphere, have an example of another country, a country that's very similar to the United States in a number of different ways, where a similar right-wing authoritarian leader who is so similar to Donald Trump that he was called the Trump of the tropics tried to do the exact same thing as Trump people tried doing on January 6th. Yes, on January 8th, 2023, thousands of supporters of Brazilian president who had just lost re-election, Jair Bolsonaro, did exactly the same thing as Trump supporters did. They attacked the building where the Brazilian equivalent of Congress is and various other, like, you know, federal government facilities. And like their cousins in the United States, these Bolsonaro supporters failed to halt the transfer of power in Brazil. But, you know, in terms of their approach, from the perspective of those trying to stop the transition of power in Brazil, it really was very similar to the, you know, the Trump version 2 years prior, in the sense that it wasn't just this sort of riot on January 8th. Like, there was, you know, a bunch of efforts by Bolsonaro and his political allies to fuck with the bureaucratic processes of the transition of power. And Bolsonaro himself, in one funny anecdote, apparently went to the leaders of the Brazilian military and basically said to them, "Hi guys, would you like to help me carry out a coup d'etat to stop the transition of power?" And apparently they kind of said, "No, we're not going to be doing that, and if you try it, we might arrest you." So, you know, nice to know that the Brazilian military's head is screwed on straight, at least when it comes to preserving democracy in their country. What is different between, you know, January 6th and the surrounding events versus January 8th in Brazil, 2023, and the surrounding events has been the response of Brazil's political system. Unlike in the United States, where over time, a lot of the Republican Party really has just kind of tried to memory hold January 6th and, you know, continue the lies about the election having been stolen in some way. In Brazil, basically the entire political system, even though many of them had very, very, in my opinion, valid concerns about certain parts of Lula da Silva's ideology, they all came together and were like, "Yeah, no, we're not going to be doing that. We're not going to be violently overthrowing the transition of power in this country." Also, when it came to how they handled the rioters specifically, there was none of this, oh yeah, well, we'll let them go home and then arrest them in a couple of weeks. It's like, no. They rounded these fuckers up, as far as I'm aware. I could be wrong about that, but my understanding is that in Brazil, justice was, well, to quote the villain in V for Vendetta, swift, righteous, and I'm not going to say without mercy, but certainly with, I think, less than was given to the January 6th rioters in the United States. Furthermore, and again, this happened in 2023, so a lot less time has passed since Bolsonaro's attempt to do a January 6th and Trump's attempted January 6th coup, but not too long after this happened, a panel of judges in Brazil blocked Bolsonaro from ever again seeking political office until at least 2030. So, you know, a sort of return like Trump's trying to do right now in order to say, you can't prosecute me because if you do, it's election interference type thing is off the table. Furthermore, the justice system in Brazil really does just seem to have been moving quite a bit more quickly when it comes to actually chasing after Bolsonaro. So he's on the hook for various different things, including not just the stuff around his attempt to overthrow the election where he lost, but also apparently for anyone who doesn't know this, Bolsonaro is a real weirdo when it came to COVID, and he falsified all of his vaccine records, apparently, which is a crime in Brazil. So he's in very serious legal trouble, which, you know, kudos to Brazil. Maybe the United States can learn something from Brazil about how to handle corrupt authoritarian political leaders who think the rules don't apply to them. But the reason I bring this up this week is that in the context of Bolsonaro seeming to realize he's in serious legal trouble, he appears to be now looking for a rat hole of some sort. I remain curious to see when Trump is going to suddenly make an unexpected trip to Moscow and not come back. But in the case of Bolsonaro, since he doesn't have the option to avoid justice by, you know, running for president again and declaring that every attempt to hold him accountable is election interference or something, which is Trump's approach to his legal troubles so far, Bolsonaro, like the day after he left office, just went and hung out in Miami for a couple of months. I think he visited Mar-a-Lago, just kind of hung out with, you know, in Florida for a while. He also has gone to hang out in Argentina, where they have their own pretty right-wing leader that took over a couple of months ago. But again, the reason I'm bringing up this week, the Bolsonaro situation this week, is because this week, he just sort of randomly showed up at the Hungarian embassy in Brazil and went inside and didn't come out for like several days. And it's like he went over there for like a slumber party for a couple days. And a bunch of people were kind of like, you know, is he trying to pull a Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy in London thing? And frankly, if there were any country whose right-wing authoritarian leader would be willing to mess with another country by giving asylum to a former head of state that's facing criminal justice in that country, it is certainly Viktor Orban's Hungary. There's a lot more that could be said about Viktor Orban's Hungary, but you know, there's several other things I want to talk about this episode, and this is already dragging out a little bit, so I won't go into tons of detail about how terrible Viktor Orban is. But yeah, it seemed like maybe it was a test run. Another thing that happened in Brazil is that Bolsonaro was wanting to go and visit Israel. And fortunately, a judge in Brazil denied his request to, like, have his passport back so that he could go there. And thank God for that. Partly just because, you know, they should probably want to keep a close eye on this guy, but also because I can very much see why Benjamin Netanyahu would want to have this happen. I can see why the Netanyahu regime would want to give asylum to Jair Bolsonaro. I mean, Israel does not have a good relationship with Lula da Silva for reasons that are understandable in the context of the way Lula handles anything to do with Israel. And also, them accepting Bolsonaro would piss off the Biden administration, which I think Benjamin Netanyahu is very much leaning into at the moment. As a lot of commentators have pointed out, virtually all Israeli prime ministers up until now have partially been judged how they've done their in terms of how they've done their job on how well they maintain the relationship with the United States. Whereas Benjamin Netanyahu really seems to be doing basically the opposite thing, where for domestic political reasons, he wants to be able to put himself, you know, in a position of being like, look at me, I'm the only one who will stand up to the Biden administration that's asking us to be more restrained or something. And
So I can see Benjamin Netanyahu specifically wanting to offer asylum to Jair Bolsonaro, and for the good of Israel, that cannot happen. It would be a disaster for Israel. It would ruin Israel's already rather complex relationship to a number of Latin American countries, and it would seriously piss off the Biden administration, which, again, the Israeli government really can't afford to keep doing. Again, even if Benjamin Netanyahu does see it as being in his short-term political interest. And frankly, considering that there were massive protests in Israel's two largest cities over the last weekend against him calling for new elections in Israel, I could see him maybe thinking it is in his political interest to stage some sort of ridiculous distraction by interfering in the politics of a large South American country in a way that would certainly piss off the Biden administration and invite criticism from the outside, which Benjamin Netanyahu for some reason seems to just thrive on. In any case, it's a good thing that a judge in Brazil has blocked Bolsonaro's request to, "Can I have my passport back, please?" In order to go visit Israel, and hopefully that's the end of it. Again, props to Brazil for having a justice system that is putting our own to shame when it comes to holding corrupt, traitorous former political leaders to account. All right, so before we move into take two, looking at the giant Biden campaign fundraiser last week in the broader context of why Democrats really do need a huge cash advantage in order to even have a fair fight in the election this November, I just want to encourage anybody who hasn't already to be sure to follow or subscribe to the podcast channel on whatever platform you listen. And if you have ideas for the show, things you think I should be talking about, or people you think I should have on, please do go ahead and reach out at oktalkspodcast@gmail.com. All right, so now for take two. Another big story from this last week was the attention gotten by the big, giant, glitzy, like $25 million fundraiser that was held in Radio City Music Hall in New York, where President Biden was joined by the two previous former Democratic presidents and Stephen Colbert and Lizzo. It was a huge, star-studded, massive, and very lucrative fundraiser. And there was a lot of attention to this because of that, and then also about, you know, to the protests by anti-Israel people outside, which I will talk about at some point, either in a take in this episode or possibly as a separate episode entirely. But for now, I just want to focus in on the giant fundraiser of it all, because it did get a lot of attention. And this ties into the broader theme of there has been a lot of coverage lately of the fact that the Biden campaign has been doing very, very well when it comes to fundraising. And I have mixed feelings about this, because on the one hand, an argument could be made, this is just Democrats looking rich and out of touch, and the Trump people have tried to lean into this. Some people have seen it as sort of like gloating, ha-ha, look, Biden's raking in all this money and Trump's spending all of his money on legal fees. And I think that's a totally fair contrast to bring up. But one thing that I think hasn't been being talked about so much when it comes to this, and I will say again, in the long term, I'm not sure it is a good thing that so much of the attention of the campaign go toward, look how much money they've raised, because, you know, okay. But a thing that, as I say, I think has not been talked about enough in the context of this is the reality just that at this point, Democrats need to have a huge fundraising advantage, which structurally we tend not to, because historically it's basically been a situation where, especially after Citizens United happened, where, you know, more rich people are voting Republican, and those people give a ton of money to the Republicans, and that can basically be laundered through super PACs where you don't really have to disclose donors, and the money can come from anywhere, and the rationale was always, corporations and unions can give unlimited money, but that includes unions. But yeah, sorry, corporations have more money. Okay. Bottom line, sorry, to get back to the point I'm trying to make here. The reality is that right now, for a number of reasons, Democrats need to have a huge cash advantage in order to have anything close to a fair fight in a national level election in the United States. And that is because although there are more Democrats in the United States than Republicans, and, you know, if you want evidence of that, I'll point you to the fact that Democrats have won the popular vote in every single presidential election since 1998, except for 2004, which is to say Democrats have won 7 out of the last 8 national elections in the United States. The 51 Democrats in the Senate represent millions more votes than the 49 Republicans in the Senate. But even though there are definitely more Democrats in the United States than there are Republicans, the reality is that for, again, a couple of structural reasons, Democrats already were operating at a disadvantage when it comes to, say, the Electoral College. It's often pointed out every couple of years that Democrats, realistically, to win the Electoral College, with the way the states are distributed right now, really kind of need to win the popular vote by at least like 4 or 5%. I mean, you look at 2016, for example, when Hillary won the popular vote by 3 million votes, and yet Donald Trump still managed to scrape a win in the Electoral College. But it's more than just the disadvantage in the Electoral College and then the inherent weird anti-democratic unfairness of the Senate. It is that in the modern era, the Republican Party is willing to play the game of politics in a way that Democrats just aren't, and the American political system is ripe for weird efforts to fuck with it that the Republicans are ready and willing to do. So I'll just point at the 2020 election, for example. Fortunately, the Biden team was at least sort of ready for this then, and we kind of guessed that this was going to be the case, but the reality is, given the way in which at various local level situations, at county elections boards and various things like this, Republicans are able to just bring in weird random challenges and stuff like that, Democrats have to basically spend absurd amounts of money on legal efforts to make sure that votes, you know, are counted, to prevent frivolous attempts to overthrow the results of the election. And I'm just talking about stuff that Republicans can and in the last couple of election cycles have been doing to try to interfere with the vote at the local level, with having poll watchers there to, you know, menace people coming to vote and people challenging every single vote by a person that they assume was probably, for demographic reasons, they think was a Democrat. I haven't even gone into that much the other things that Republicans do to try to suppress the vote, as I've talked about in previous episodes. Voter ID laws, closing polling places in predominantly minority areas, the fact that, I don't remember the exact statistic, but something in the last election in Georgia, the average wait time in, like, wealthier, whiter areas of Atlanta was like 20 minutes to vote, and in poorer, blacker areas was like multiple hours. And then, of course, there's the law they passed in Georgia to, like, forbid you from giving a water bottle to somebody waiting in line to vote. Bottom line, Democrats have to spend a whole bunch of money just to overcome the barriers, to help their voters overcome the barriers that have been set by Republicans in an attempt to try to prevent people they don't want to vote from voting. Which is to say, with the combination of these various factors that I mentioned, the reality is that right now Democrats just have a way heavier lift in order to win an election in America. Or in order, I should say, to have a fair election in America that represents the will of the majority of the American people. So, yeah, you know, I don't love all this coverage of like, oh, look, here's this big glitzy fundraiser. And like some Republicans have tried pointing out the contrast between like, well, you know, while Biden was broing out at with all these, you know, former presidents and big stars in a glitzy New York fundraiser, Trump was in New York to attend the funeral of a slain police officer. And of course, my deepest condolences to the family of this slain police officer. But like, yeah, sure, the split screen of, oh, Trump was at this funeral and the Democrats are having a giant party. Like, you know, yeah, sure, I understand. It's not a great split screen. And I don't love all the coverage of, like, the Democrats, you know, having this huge financial advantage. Because, yeah, it does take away from the sort of scrappy underdog thing. But on the other hand, this is just what Democrats need to be able to have a fair fight in November. Which is something that I think needs to be remembered in the context of all of this coverage of the giant fundraisers. Speaking of having a fair fight, or not, let's move on to Take 3, where I have a look at the Russian campaign to kidnap Western civilians in order to use them as political chips in their ongoing war that they're waging against the West, whether we want to recognize it or not. So this past week saw the one-year anniversary of Russia's kidnap of Wall Street Journal journalist Evan Gershkovitz. I'm sure somebody might be saying, Oliver, he wasn't kidnapped, he was arrested. Yeah, okay. I'm going to use the word kidnap from here on out to refer to citizens of Western countries that are arrested by the Russians on trumped-up charges in order to fuck with the United States, because that is what happened with Evan Gershkovitz, it's what's happened with various others, which I'll get into in a minute. Another reason that I am insisting that we use the word kidnapping to refer to what the Russians have been doing to various citizens of Western countries when they arrest them on trumped-up charges is the way in which they've been using these people for, you know, effectively political purposes. Look at the case of Brittany Griner, for example. This was a case, like, in the last couple of years, where an American basketball player was for some reason in Russia and was arrested and basically sent to a gulag because she had like trace amounts of cannabis oil left over in, you know, her vape pen or something. But I mean, let's be realistic. The reason this woman was arrested is because she's a relatively high-profile American citizen, and she's a black woman, which means that arresting, kidnapping her would create political problems for the Biden administration, and that's why the Russians did it. Because by holding this person as a hostage, effectively, they were able to get the Americans to release Victor Boot, who, as I understand it, is literally the inspiration for Nick Cage's character in the movie Lord of War. He was a vicious arms dealer who had been in American prison for about 10 years, and the Russians were able to get us to trade this human landfill for this innocent woman who just happened to make the profound mistake of being a basketball player who would go for some reason to Russia. And now, in this situation with Evan Gershkovitz, it's becoming increasingly clear that the Russians have another trade in mind. A couple of years ago, a Russian intelligence officer, effectively think, in broad daylight in Berlin, tracked down some, you know, former Russian dissident who was living in Berlin and shot this person in the face in broad daylight in like a park. And the Germans managed to arrest this guy. And, you know, the Russians want him back now. So they kidnap an American journalist in the hopes that maybe they can get the Americans to pressure the Germans into giving this guy back. And, you know, I'm sorry, but we cannot do it. And it's easy for me to say because, you know, I'm Evan Gershkovitz and Brittany Griner and all these people, you know, they're not my friends or my family. So I understand it's easy for me to be saying this, but I think that it might have been a mistake to have traded Victor Boot for Brittany Griner. I mean, it's horrible what happened to her. It's horrible what's been happening to Evan Gershkovitz. It's horrible what's been happening to other American hostages like Paul Whelan that are in Russian custody at the moment. But, you know, we have the policy of not negotiating with terrorists for a reason. I'm totally open to the possibility that I could be wrong on this. Morally, it's really complicated. But I have trouble with the notion that we should be ever giving back legitimate Russian prisoners in exchange for kidnapped Western citizens. Because all it does is incentivize them to kidnap more of them. As I say, there are numerous Americans that are hostages of the Russians at this point. And if we create a playing field in which the Russians can basically have their intelligence services operate with impunity in the West, kill whoever they want to kill in our countries, which they've done a number of times with very few consequences in the past decade. I mean, multiple British civilians were murdered by idiot, incompetent Russian assassins who used a WMD, seriously, they used Novichok, which is a WMD nerve agent to try to murder, an ex-Russian dissident and his daughter who lived in the UK. And in so doing, they accidentally killed a couple of British civilians and not their actual target. Not that it would have been okay for them to kill their actual target either. But like, we can't allow the Russians to use Western Europe as a playground for their spy agencies to kill anybody they want to. And if we teach them the lesson that, okay, you can do that, you'll get a slap on the wrist, and then when we arrest your thugs that you sent to do this, all you got to do is kidnap an American and we'll spring these people out of jail. I don't see that as being a serious way that we can handle the Russians. The only language these people speak, at least this administration and Russia speaks, is force. And that's quite obvious in a number of their behaviors. And I just feel like giving in to them by basically being willing to make trades for hostages seems to me in the long term like probably a mistake. All right, with all that said, to end this episode on a lighter note, I guess it's lighter? It feels lighter. Hucksterism feels lighter than kidnapping to me, I guess. Here comes take four. So, the traveling Bible salesman is a trope that appears often in literature or pop culture to represent hucksterism, sort of selling snake oil, like disingenuous profiteering at the expense of gullible potential customers. Which is why it is so wonderfully, unironically appropriate that this last week, this happened.
All Americans need a Bible in their home, and I have many. It's my favorite book. It's a lot of people's favorite book. This Bible is a reminder that the biggest thing we have to bring back America and to make America great again is our religion. Promoting the God Bless the USA Bible. This Bible is the King James Version and also includes our founding father documents. Yes, the Constitution, which I'm fighting for every single day. Christians are under siege. We must protect content that is pro-God. We love God. I'm proud to endorse and encourage you to get this Bible. We must make America pray again. I think you all should get a copy of God Bless the USA Bible now and help spread our Christian values with others.
Yeah. So if I could just translate that, with apologies to Nate who hates my aggressively mediocre Trump impression. Attention, gullible rubes. Look, I've got some tremendous legal bills. Very unfair. It's a rigged system. From that time I allegedly paid off a porn star not to tell anybody about the affair we had while wife number three was at home taking care of the newborn, Byron or Bruno or whatever. So, look, I took this Bible, put a flag on it. It's my favorite book. I've read it lots of times, that I can tell you. Believe me, 2 Corinthians, am I right? Totally believe all this stuff about the whale and the talking bush and the jinns and all that. We sure do love God, don't we? Tremendous guy, really tremendous. So, this Easter, what better way to spend your hard-earned Social Security money than to help out your fellow Christian, Donald Trump, by buying this book you already have 10 copies of for the low, low price of $59.99, shipping not included. Happy Easter. I hope Santa brings some tremendous eggs this year. We sure do love those eggs, don't we? We sure do. Thank you.
Now, part of me wants to try to feel sorry for the inevitable victims of this obvious scam. But, you know, try as I might, neither my empathy nor my sympathy are limitless. I mean, a lot of people have scratched their heads for years as to how evangelical Protestants, the people most likely to explain their reasoning on any given issue, whether or not it feels like a non sequitur, by telling you some form of, well, I'm a Christian. I mean, I know tons of us wonder how it is that those people could so overwhelmingly support the single least godly human being in the history of American politics. But on the other hand, to be fair, the evangelical community has long been rather rife with hypocrisy when it comes to politics. I mean, during the War on Terror, for example, they were the religious group in America by far most likely to support torturing detainees. I mean, hey, maybe I just read the wrong copy of the Bible, because in the one I read, the phrase, turn the other cheek, wasn't followed immediately by, so I have a better angle to stick this cattle prod. So, you know, maybe I'm just wrong when I say that it feels rather odd how many people for whom the first layer of their identity is to be proudly Christian seem to be worshiping this particular golden calf. Or I guess, you know, he's more of a bronze color these days. The idea of Donald Trump messianic religious figure was made all the more ironic by the fact that while Biden attended Easter Mass and released a nice message to Christians celebrating the holiday, Trump spent the day posting more than 70 unhinged, all-caps rants on his weird little social media platform, including articles that compared him, Donald Trump, to Jesus, and images explicitly calling for violence against Joe Biden. Now, I can hardly sit here and tell you that I spent Easter prayerfully reflecting on the themes of sacrifice and hope embodied by the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth, or for some reason a rabbit laying eggs. But nor am I running a political campaign that can reasonably expect to receive the support of an overwhelming majority of America's most obsessive Christians, and holding political rallies that end with, as the New York Times put it, theatrical sermons complete with a cinematic music track. My God, what a weird time to be alive. In any case, that's it for this episode of OK Talks. If you like the show and want to make sure not to miss the next episode, be sure to follow on whatever platform you listen or shoot me an email at oktalkspodcast@gmail.com to be added to the email list. I just want to reiterate what I said at the top. Please do feel free to reach out if you have ideas for the show or a topic you'd be interested in hearing me weigh in on, someone you think I should have on. I can't promise I'll always be able to answer or very quickly, but I do mean it. I'd love to hear from you. oktalkspodcast@gmail.com. If you really want to do me a solid, please do go ahead and share the show with anybody you think might get something out of it. To anybody who already has, thank you. To anybody who will, thanks in advance. Thanks as always to Nate Wright for having designed the podcast artwork, and to everyone else for listening.